Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. This is also Blue Lives Radio, the voice of Blue Lives Matter. This is a very special episode. Because of the importance of this topic, there will be no view from the blue. There will be nothing else other than the interview with police officer Anne Marie Carrizales, who suffered through PTSD after her heroic actions during a gunfight when she was shot in the line of duty. This is a very, very important interview, and anyone in law enforcement who has faced such emotional, tragic issues as the death of someone close to them or a traumatic incident needs to listen to Anne Marie. We're going to get right into it now. Welcome to Police Radio, Anna. Great to have you.
Hey, thanks, Randy. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, you know what? You're currently a police officer in Texas at the Meadows Place Police Department, where you've been working for about a year. But before that, you were with Stafford PD in Texas.
Yes, and, I sure was.
And You had a life-changing experience when you were with them. Would you kind of go into that with the listening audience and tell them a little bit about your story?
Well, it was in October of 2013, October 26, 2013, and I made a traffic stop like I had done a million times before. It was about 3:40 or so in the morning, and I happened to come upon three occupants in a car, three MS-13 gang members, and we had a little short dialogue. I could tell something wasn't right. I could feel it, but it was about, a few minutes in, very short dialogue, that I got ambushed by the front seat passenger, opened fire on me, shot me in the face and in the chest. So it was kind of at that moment right then that I knew this was definitely not going to be a typical traffic stop, to say the least.
No, I'd say not. So you of course, at the time of the car stop, what did you make the stop for?
There was actually some suspicious activity that caught my attention when I saw the car, but there were some minor traffic infractions that they'd made. They were sitting idle in a main road there, known as FM 1092, and they were facing southbound at the stoplight with the left blinker on, but they were not in the left turning lane. So what I was watching was, is this person going to turn, you know, from the wrong lane, make a left turn from the wrong lane and run this red light? But what they ended up doing was sitting through two go cycles or so of the traffic light. They wouldn't move through the green light. They wouldn't turn even when the turn signal turned green. So that kind of caught my attention, and I started watching them as I was driving northbound on that road, and thought, well, it could be a couple things. You know, if you've ever worked a beat on night shift, you have definitely had the fine privilege of coming upon a drunk guy at a stoplight passed out. So I thought it could be something like that, or maybe the car was broken down. But after a van had to go around the car to go through the green light, I went ahead and flipped around and decided to initiate a traffic stop just based on all that stuff put together.
What time of the day was this?
This is about 3:40 at night, maybe 3:38, because I know I got shot about 3:42-ish, if that, right around there. So it was into the wee hours of the morning on a Thursday night, Friday morning, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And traffic was very minimal at that hour. And so the car caught my attention because it was one of the only cars on the road, and then all of the other circumstances combined obviously would kind of catch any police officer's attention at that hour. So yeah, it was just one of those situations where it could be something, it could be nothing. At the very least, maybe somebody who had some habits of car trouble, maybe somebody who was lost. I didn't know at that point. I knew I needed to look into it though.
Now, how many units were on the road available to back you up in this community?
Well, so a little bit about Stafford. Stafford Police Department is about 7 square miles of city that borders Houston. And we had, well, I don't really know how many we had sworn, the exact number. I want to say maybe 30, 40. Don't quote me on that, but it's not a huge agency. At the very minimal, we would have 3 police officers on duty with a supervisor. So that night we were running skeleton, you know, minimal, 3 with 1 supervisor on. There was a sergeant on duty, 3 of us officers. I was a senior officer on duty. One of my partners was at the jail. He had just made a DUI arrest. And the other officer that was on was very new. He was a rookie officer that I had trained at some point during his training program. And he was on duty with me as well. He'd only been out of the program for, you know, few months, maybe after that, at that point. And so it was me and him in the city.
So that's pretty light. And you were, yes. You were by yourself when you made the car stop.
Yes, I was by myself. I mean, you know, I'm by myself. In this day and age, you will have the luxury of always having somebody with you when you make the stop. So I was by myself. Whenever we have someone out of the city like that, I try really hard not to initiate and get into anything, just knowing that it's just me and another officer. The supervisor was at the police department at the time that I made the stop and asked me, did I need a check by unit? He was there, it was almost 4 in the morning. We got off at 6. He was running through reports, checking paperwork, doing sergeant stuff. And so I usually try not to initiate too much if I don't have to, just knowing that I only have, you know, 1 other available unit. But some about this situation, this car, just a feeling that I was getting. You know, it's just the instinct. You had a gut feeling about something, and that's kind of what I was feeling. So I went ahead and initiated that stop, and they ended up pulling into a trailer park, and that's where it all went down.
So you received two. He fired at you twice. You got hit in your vest, and then you got shot in the face as well.
Yes. I took 2 shots. The first one was to my left cheekbone area. The subject shot me with a 9mm point blank in my face. I didn't actually see him produce the weapon. It was just really, Randy, I don't have to tell you, when stuff goes down south, it's seconds, you know. Right. And I didn't see him produce it, but I looked at him at the precise moment that he fired. I saw the muzzle flash shoot out at me. Of course, heard the gunshot and the loud ringing in my ear. And the bullet entered my left cheekbone, went through my cheek, and came out the left side of my jaw there by my earlobe, and took my earlobe apart when it came out there. And I remember locking in on that weapon that he fired, so I was able to. I immediately could see that it was a 9mm, and then I went ahead and locked in on his eyes, and just stayed there as my head was kind of flying back. You know, by this time slowed down, and everything is just being absorbed into my mind. My brain is trying to process everything. So I saw the gun, I saw his face, I saw, you know, it's kind of crazy, my face, my eyes locking in on his eyes for so long, to the point that I could actually see his facial expression change from the moment he shot me to the moment right after he shot me, in between the first and second shot. So we were really locked in on each other, and I saw those eyes, boy, I saw those eyes everywhere for a good long bit after that happened.
Yeah, I'll bet you did. But right after he fired at you, what was your response?
My first thought, now, I don't know if you remember from hearing the presentation that we were at together, but I had had an officer-involved shooting the year prior, almost the exact day the year prior. I had an officer-involved shooting on October 14th, 2012. And right. I always, you know, I'm a former fighter, right? So I was a boxing champion. So I always like to kind of refer to these as my rounds. That was my round one, was that first shooting. I think it's so important when I'm talking to speaking to other officers that we really kind of reflect on some things, because I think that with that shooting in October of 2012, I really learned a lot of things, and I took a lot from that incident and knew what I wanted to do in the future and what I did not want to do again in the future. I took that all out from the first shooting. So for the better part of that year, I couldn't shake this sinking feeling, man, that like it was going to happen again. I knew deep in my gut that I was going to be in another fight for my life, and I couldn't tell you why. Still to this day can't explain it. It was just a feeling that came over me that I knew it was going to happen again, and I was going to be prepared. I wanted to be 100% prepared. I didn't feel like I was 100% prepared in that first shooting. Of course, I made it home, and I did a good job. I did what I was supposed to do, and I made it home, but that's just not enough. That's especially in this day and age. That's just not enough, and there were things I recognized that I could have done better in terms of preparation. Little things, making sure my equipment was up to par, that it was fastened on my gear belt properly, and things like that, just little things. And I made it a point to really focus on that. So for the better part of the year, I prepared. I prepared for what I knew was coming. Didn't know when, didn't know what, didn't know how, who, but I knew it was coming. And so when I took that first shot to my face that next year, at that traffic stop, one of the first things that crossed my mind when I felt myself get shot was, you know, it's happening. It's happened.
Wow.
I knew it. I knew it. I almost said that. Like, I knew it, you know. It was like, geez, I knew this. I knew it. But I tell you, I kind of felt something come over me in that moment that my mind thought, it's happening. You know, it's happened. This kind of, I say excitement, but, you know, I would never say that to, like, in the press, excited, because, you know, how I feel like it could be twisted or,
sure,
you know, misconstrued. But there was this sense of excitement inside of me, because I knew that I was ready. I knew I was ready for it. I didn't feel like I was being caught unprepared at this point. So I was ready to deal with whatever came. And it's a good thing, because I ended up catching another one in the left side of my left breast. And I thought, well, they're really trying to kill me. as if getting shot in the face wasn't indication enough, right?
But you didn't lay down. You just you took action.
Oh, yes. No, I didn't lay down. And one of the things I really like to stress when I'm speaking is, and you'll probably remember me saying this, but, you know, the body will only go where the mind's ever taken it. So it's not going to go. If you've never taken it there in your mind, the body isn't going to go there. And that's just the way we as human beings are wired. The body will not go where the mind has not taken it. And I had never been shot like that before, but in my mind I'd been shot like that a million times, because I spent that year putting myself in different situations in my mind, and that was one of them, walking up to the car. I don't know a cop alive who's never thought about maybe walking up to a car and taking one right in the face. So I just did that. I prepared. So in that moment, you know, yeah, my legs felt like giving out. Yeah, it hurt like a mother. You know, the second shot knocked me back three steps. And, you know, I'm not some tiny little chick. I'm pretty strong. And it just manhandled me. That second shot, I remember feeling that second shot hit me on the left side of my chest. And I thought, oh, God, my vest didn't catch that one. I felt the round go into my body. I felt the blood trickle down my rib cage. And it's kind of crazy, the things your mind, you know this better, you know, just as good as anyone. Your mind, the way the mind processes stuff like this, when the stuff starts to fly, the mind will slow way down in order to process all of this craziness.
So let me just clarify. So when you got hit the second time, the vest did not deflect it?
Here's the thing. The vest did catch the bullet, but the portion of the vest where the round struck, when I took that first shot to my face, I started to lift my left hand up to the side of my face in like a defensive mechanism,
right,
like a
mm-hmm.
defensive mode, like much like in boxing. When you see a boxer, they raise their elbows forward slightly and their hand kind of comes up to cuff the side of the face to defend from punches. Well, that's my body automatically did that. And as I did that, I was drawing my firearm with my right arm, and I was starting to turn to my right to make a tactical retreat and engage in this gun battle, right? So As I was lifting my hand up, I'm turning to my right. The second shot hits me on the left side of my left breast. So you're talking, there's almost no vest left there anymore. This is the portion of the vest that cuffs underneath our armpit right alongside of the chest area.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a vest that was custom fit for my body, but women's vests almost cut in a little bit further because of the breasts and the shape of our body. And so, as you know, some of these vests aren't even graded like an inch and a half out. You know, I'm not a vest expert, but I know that much to know. And so it just really hit me at the softest point of the vest that I think you could have possibly hit me at, and that would still have paneling in there. And it was at point-blank range, so it went in, I think, and this is my theory, because no one has been able to explain it to me to include point blank. The people from point blank, which was the vest I was wearing, came down, and my chief and I asked, you know, do you know why she would have sustained the injury that she got to her chest? And they said, oh, it's pretty common to have, like, some abrasions, bruising, sometimes even a little bit of broken skin. Well, I had a hole in my left breast.
That's a little different.
And as a matter of fact, it almost cleared my entire chest cavity, that bullet. But like when you hit a heavy bag, if you can imagine punching a heavy bag, pow, you punch it and it swings forward and then it comes back, right?
Right.
I can only imagine that when it hit that first panel, it kind of deflected a little bit. The round bounced or ricocheted or whatever you want to call it off of that first panel and went off to the right. Well, there was no more vest there. So it goes in, pierces my body, but then the momentum pops back out. The vest pops back out. It held on to that round. So although I had a very, very deep open entry wound on my left breast, the vest ultimately held on to the round. So it didn't stay inside my body.
Wow, that's interesting.
It's very interesting. And I've always been curious to work with somebody who's an expert in this area to figure out what happened here, because I actually showed a picture to the people that came down from point blank and they were appalled. They could not, they had no words. I don't know if you know this, but I had to have a partial mastectomy of my left breast because of the injury that I sustained from the round.
Wow. But you, so you're hit twice and then you return fire.
Yes. Once I took that second round, a couple of different things kind of started to shoot through my mind. And then I remember one of them being, hey, you're in a gun battle here, girl. You better start shooting. I'll never forget that thought. That is exactly the phrase that went, you're in a gun battle here, girl. You better, any day you want to start shooting. And in my mind, it felt like maybe there was some time in between the taking the shots and me returning fire. But in reality, there was none. I took the second shot, knocked me back three steps. And as soon as I landed, I started to count my steps. One, two, three. It was something that I did in boxing, because I was very effective as a counterpuncher. So that was one of the things that I remember doing in boxing, and it was autopilot in this critical incident. It just came back. I started counting one, two, three, and in between there, the three steps, I could feel my knees wanting to give out, much like in boxing when I got my clock cleaned really, really good. So I just said, don't go down, don't go down. I just told myself, don't go down, don't go down. I didn't want to be on my back, obviously on the ground on my back with these three, you know, thugs in the car that could have just run me over or done whatever. So I just said, don't go down, don't go down. And when my right leg planted on three, I flipped around and I started engaging the threat, and I started popping off rounds. And of course, they're going to do what these cowards often do that when they do something like this. What do they do? What do they do?
They ran.
They run, you know, and I just remember being so angry, like, are you serious right now? Like, you start this gun battle with me, there's three of you, there's one of me, and you guys run. And I just felt very angry about that, like, you know, hold on, wait a minute here, you just just shot me, and now you just want to drive away. That's absolutely not going to go down like that. and I knew that they would kill someone else out there. I knew it. So I did an immediate quick self-assessment of myself. I took my fingers, and I tapped my fingers to my thumb, one finger by one. So index, middle, ring finger, pinky to my thumb on both hands. And I went back and forth like that a couple times as I'm walking back to my patrol car. And I started combat breathing. I took my tongue. I ran it across my teeth, top and bottom a couple times. I wanted to make sure all my teeth were there because at this point it just felt like my face was broken. Oh, like Mike Tyson, you know, just nailed into me. And I knew I could breathe. I had a pulse. I had my fine motor skills. I had all my faculties about me. My airway wasn't obstructed with teeth or anything. So I could talk because I got on my radio immediately and said that there were shots fired. So I knew that I had all of the things that I needed to stay in the fight. And so that's when I chose to pursue.
And that was a hellacious pursuit, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah, it was quite a ride, man. it was quite a ride.
You know, I want to tell the listener something. I heard the radio traffic from this incident, and the radio traffic was absolutely phenomenal. You would never have known that you were as injured as badly as you were.
Right. Right.
How long did the pursuit go?
48 hours? No, I'm kidding. I don't
really
know.
It felt like that long.
It felt like that long. But I know that it was maybe a seven, eight, 9 minute pursuit.
And they were doing about 100 miles an hour, if I remember correct.
Right, right. I remember at one point looking down at my speedometer and my Crown Vic. She rode like a champ that night, man. I got to give her props. She just, I still get goosebumps when I look, you know, whenever I see the video or, you know, I play the video when I'm presenting to other law enforcement agencies. And I still get goosebumps when I hear that engine revving up in that Crown Vic. There's no other sweeter sound than that, man. But it was a bit of a lengthy pursuit. We got up to about 120. I remember looking down, and my speeds were really high up to about right there at the 120 mark. And they're shooting at me while I'm pursuing them. They're shooting at me from the open window because, you know, my first shot blew out the rear window of the car as they were leaving. So none of them in the car were hit. My rounds placed, boom, from what I was told by the criminalist, one round went through the windshield in between the driver and passenger seat and, like, just obliterated the stereo system.
So how did the pursuit end?
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. Well, it's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. You'll find a whole host of shows and a lineup of great content back at AmericaOutLoud.com.
Well, we ended up in an area in Houston that I was not familiar with. They started to, when they turned into their neighborhood that I think one of them or more than one of them lived in an apartment complex, one of the things that I did notice is that as we got to that area, they signaled their turn and telling me where they were going. And that really set off my alarm bells because I'm thinking, well, these guys, you know, were just running like bats out of hell trying to get the hell away from me. Which, by the way, they didn't know it was me. And I actually found out later that they thought I had died there at the trailer park.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So they did not know that was me initially chasing them. And they start to signal their turn and slow way down as they get back down in there to where they know where they're at. I know we were in their turf. I knew that they wanted me to follow. I felt like I was being baited. And at that point, I was still by myself. The cavalry hadn't arrived. And I decided to go ahead as we were coming down the last little road there. I just disengaged at that point. I went ahead and terminated the pursuit. A couple of seconds after I did that, and was calling out the block range. My sergeant said, hey, go ahead and stand down, hold your ground. And it was nice to feel like, hey, we're on the same page here. You know, that's years of working together, and we were on the same page. And the idea was, let's just set up a perimeter and see. But I'm not going down there because I really felt like I was being baited into an ambush.
I knew that I
didn't come all the way that far to die out there in some, you know, crap area of Houston. It wasn't going to happen. So I just went ahead and stood my ground there, and everybody did arrive, and they start setting up a perimeter. And of course, then it's time for me to kind of relinquish command of that scene and deal with my own injuries, because I could feel myself getting that dump. I could feel.
Well, you were working up pure adrenaline. You were working up pure adrenaline at that moment.
I'm sure adrenaline was going and pumping, but I got to tell you, you know, I've been in situations where I felt like adrenaline kind of took me a little over, and I know that obviously the adrenaline is pumping in a situation like this, but, you know, Randy, I really felt so completely focused and clear and lucid, and I was very calm. I really don't, and I could feel the pain of the chest and feel the pain in my face. I remember one time, you know, because I started to have problems in the car with things like sweaty palms, and every time I had my handheld radio to transmit, it would slide down like it was going to fall out of my hand, and so I would transmit, hit the bottom of that handheld radio, the in-car radio, on the top of my collarbone area where my vest is, so that it would push it back up into my hand, and then I would place my hands back on the wheel. And every time I transmitted and it would slide down, I would do this. Well, one time, the draining and the blood and all that stuff that was coming from the injury was really bothering me. It was distracting me with how I could feel it tickling, and I went to wipe, and my doggone thumb gets caught in a hole in my face, and I, like, yanked my head back.
Oh, my God.
I was like, okay, hands away from the face. Like, we are not touching the face anymore. But I know that I had adrenaline pumping, but I really, truly feel like there were other times outside of this incident that I had it pumping even more than it was in that moment. Just in that moment, I was so crystal clear. And there toward the end, when I said, I need to stop, I got out of the car and leaned over on my push bumper. As you can see on the dash cam, I lean over. And that's because at this point, I can't even feel my legs. So I knew it was time to stop. You know, I knew it was time.
I'd say that's good self-awareness.
Yeah. I knew that I was starting to feel, you know, the tingling in my face and the legs. I knew my feet were working because I could hit the gas and the brake and to pull over, but I was losing that feeling, and I knew it was time to stop. And I don't have any problem saying I need to stop. You know, nobody was going to blame me if I couldn't go anymore, and I wasn't worried about what anybody thought at that time. I know there's some people who've asked me, you know, do you think it was reckless for you to hop in that car and chase them after you'd been shot twice? Well, you know, I could totally understand why somebody might think that, but I can say with beyond the shadow of a doubt that I am very aware of myself and my body, and I've had the experience to know what it feels like to lose consciousness. And if I would have felt in any way that I was on the verge of, you know, losing consciousness, or that I didn't have all my faculties about me, I certainly wouldn't have gotten in the car and pursued. But I knew that I could. I knew that I needed to. My heart was ticking, and as long as my heart was ticking and I was good to go, then I was not going to be out of that fight at all by any means. It was just not an option.
I got you. Well, so the perimeter was set up. Eventually, everybody was arrested.
Right. At some point, when they took me out in the box to the hospital.
Not in a box. Don't say that word. Mm-hmm.
The ambulance box.
Okay.
The ambulance box. When they took me out of there to get me to the hospital to get me taken care of, the brothers and sisters from the neighboring agencies, Missouri City Police Department, you know, Sugarland, DPS, Fort Bend County, Harris County, HPD, everybody was there. And they had set up a perimeter, and from my understanding, within a couple hours, the suspect who shot me was coming down, walking in the area, and two good friends of mine, Missouri City PD officers, remembered the description that I gave dispatch while I was in pursuit of the suspects, and he matched the description. I went ahead and just started chit-chatting with him, and it turns out it was the guy. He said he was just walking to work and he didn't have a car. And, you know, good police work, good investigation skills, and they were able to connect him to the car because he actually had the keys to the car in his pocket.
Oh, there's a rocket scientist.
Yeah. So he doesn't have a car, he doesn't own a car, but he has the keys to the car that, you know, was involved in my shooting. So, you know, it wasn't pretty hard from there on out. It just kind of fell into place. The other two were outstanding until about Halloween. We did a press conference. So I was shot the 26th, October 31st. We did a press conference with Crime Stoppers of Houston, and they had just implemented this program called the Fallen Hero Program. And that is when an officer is killed or injured in the line of duty, or a first responder is killed or injured in line of duty, they double the reward money from $5,000 to $10,000. And once that was announced, it wasn't even 24 hours and the other two were in custody.
Interesting, interesting.
Yeah,
all right. So all of these guys are in custody. You're on the road to recovery. But let's fast forward a little bit. You, of course, you had some very significant injuries. You were out and, you know, recovering. And let's talk a little bit about your family life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the time that this happened, you know, you're living with your family.
My husband, my two kids. Yep. My dog.
How did they react to this horror?
You know, Randy, this incident, you have to keep in mind, they had just gone through an OIS a year prior.
Right.
And I felt like they really kept a stiff upper lip through that one. I wasn't shot in that shooting. I shot someone else, and I was injured because I was dragged, had my arm pinned in a window and dragged. So I was injured, but I was not shot. And it was still terrifying for my kids, who at the time both, you know, one was in high school and one was in elementary. My husband was woken out of his sleep, to be told. So when this, they really, I knew they were afraid for me to go back even at that point, but they believe in their mother's ability to take care of herself, and they want to support me, and they know that this is a calling for me, so they want to support me, and that's what they did. So they really kept a stiff upper lip on that first one. When I got shot in the second shooting, it was a different story. That shook our family. It just shook us to our core, and we are 3 years out. We just hit 3 years this past October, and we're still very much in the middle of putting the pieces back together. And that is what has motivated and driven me to begin speaking and sharing my story publicly.
And
because I have seen that the pain that it's caused my family, I have seen the potential for something like this to absolutely devastate and tear a family apart, a person apart. But not just the person, their entire family unit. And I felt like I was in a round, I think I call it my round three. I felt like I was in a round, in a fight with an opponent that I had not prepared for, that nobody told me I was fighting, and I was pretty pissed off about that. And I swore that if I could at all help it, I would tell every last partner I had, every last law enforcement officer who would listen, about their round three and the potential for them to have that opponent. See, it didn't come after me in round one. After round one, it really didn't come after me and my family. So because it did not, or I did not notice it, I really underestimated its ability to come for me in round three. And when I say it, I mean, you know, the post-traumatic stress issues that will come for you eventually.
You know, let's really concentrate on this, because one of the things that I think you are so effective at is being so completely honest and forthright about your round three and about how PTSD truly affected you and your family. So when did you start seeing the symptoms of PTSD?
Well, hindsight's always 20/20.
Exactly, exactly.
So looking back now, I saw them after round one. but I didn't feel them so much, and that's what can be very tricky about this stuff. Now, I want to clarify that PTS, post-traumatic stress, and PTSD are two different things.
Exactly.
Every single body who's been in a critical incident is not going to develop PTSD. As you know, I'm a Marine Corps veteran, right?
Right.
Every single military person is not going to develop PTSD, but every single cop is not going to develop PTSD, but everybody is a human being. See, this is not just a cop thing, and that's what I say. This is not just a cop thing. This is a human thing, a human being. We've all been through trauma. We've all been through something in our lives that has shaken your life to its core and made you feel like, how the hell am I going to get through this? How the hell am I going to pick up the pieces here? Whether it be, you know, the loss of a loved one or just anything, a car accident or a victim of a crime. So many different things. So this is not just a law enforcement thing. This is a people thing. And what I feel like I need to get across more than anything is that struggling with post-traumatic stress is completely normal response to an abnormal situation. It is not normal, the stuff that we see and do every day. It's just not.
Right.
And I don't care who you are. You can't go through a career in law enforcement and not be scarred in some way by the things that you've had to endure as a law enforcement officer or a first responder or a military veteran. You know, it's just, you really can't. And I think it's important to also clarify that PTSD is not a death sentence. And you know what else it's not, Randy? It's not a mental illness. Post-traumatic stress disorder, it's not a mental illness.
Exactly, exactly. And unfortunately, you know what? We're because it is such a misunderstood affliction, many people equate that with a mental illness, and it simply is not.
It's not. It is actually a brain injury. It is a medical condition. A medical condition. And I say this, you know, because you've heard me present, you know, we as cops, we use humor. We use humor to cope with a lot of things throughout our careers. And for me, it was no different. You know, I was cracking jokes when they were putting me in the ambulance. I was cracking jokes in the trauma room. I was cracking, you know, I've cracked jokes, you know, but at the end of the day, this was a crazy serious thing that happened to me. And one thing I do say is, like, if I had gynecological issues, right? If I had a gnarly yeast infection, I wouldn't go to the damn podiatrist to get that treated. You know what I'm saying? I just wouldn't. It's no different. If you have a problem with something like post-traumatic stress, then you just need to go see that specific medical doctor or that specific doctor that can handle that and treat that. And I think that's where the breakdown is. It's like, okay, if I go see a shrink, it's because I'm crazy, or it's because I'm weak, or if I see a therapist, I'm weak, I'm crazy. And that's just the stigma. We all know about it. You have to see the right doctor for the right type of treatment. And that's where people get trouble. That's where people get trouble, Randy. They have issues with post-traumatic stress, and they go untreated. They go unaddressed, and they fester. You cannot continue to put a Band-Aid on something that requires surgery. It's not going to work.
I remember that that you told some very vivid stories about how you came to realize that you were in trouble.
Yep.
And if you wouldn't mind, share that with the audience.
There were a couple of indicators when I knew I was in trouble. You know, like I said, looking back now, I saw some of the things happening after my round one, but not anything significant enough for me to feel like I needed to do anything about it. There's this thing called delayed onset post-traumatic stress that could take months or years to fester, and that's what happened. So I remember I had already gone back to work, Randy, and I was feeling good, feeling strong physically, aside from the little things that you would think are normal. So as cops, we all have trouble sleeping, and our sleep patterns are all jacked up, and we always talk about how we can't sleep, especially, you know, night shift people are always struggling. But I think that we tend to just look at that as just a job hazard because we work shift work and crazy hours and whatnot. But that's something that I think people need to pay more attention to. So I was having that problem. Even after I'd gone back to work, I was still having trouble with some sleep issues and nightmares and things like that. But hey, you know what? It happens. I wake up, it's a bad dream, I'm fine, everybody's safe, and I keep stepping. I started having issues where I felt like I was extra agitated, extra heightened. I'd go to the grocery store. I talked about the guy's eyes and how I locked in on his eyes. I would go to the grocery store, and I would see a darker-skinned Hispanic male with dark eyebrows and dark-set, deep, hollow eyes, that like his. And I immediately felt like I was going into war mode. I felt like I was ready to protect my life at all costs, just like I felt at that time. So I started to notice these things happening, but what really happened was I was on duty. I was listening to a good time radio, just driving around. It was a relaxing night. The radio was playing. Duran Duran was on. I was singing the tunes, and I felt like I couldn't finish the chorus. I couldn't breathe very well. And I noticed that I was having some trouble breathing, and I thought, well, shit, I thought, well, shoot, I've gained too much weight, and I'm having a heart attack. I didn't put too much weight on. I'm having a heart attack. I thought I was having a heart attack. I ended up getting rushed to the emergency room, and the doctor says, your heart is great. Your blood pressure still looks like an athlete, and you're great. What's your stress level like? And I was like, well, I'm a cop. I mean, what do you think it's like? And that's kind of where it started. I went home. The next day, I was going to be off for my regular days off. The next day was my Friday. I took that day off, and then I was going to have my regular days off. What happened on those days off, just that was probably the one, two, three punch combination that got me in round three. I could not stop crying. I couldn't stand. I found myself like I was counting down the days, and then like, okay, I have three more days, or I have two more days. I have to be at work, and I was just beside myself. I couldn't even stand the thought of putting my uniform on, and it wasn't fear. It was just like, ugh. I can't explain what was happening, and I couldn't stop crying, and I was trembling, and I was sweating a lot, and I was like, this is not me. What is happening to me? And I had to make a phone call. It was one of the hardest phone calls for me to make. I had to call my lieutenant and say, you remember when I promised you that I would always tell you if I wasn't okay? And he's like, yeah, yes, of course. He's like, are you okay? And I said, I'm not okay. He said, well, what's wrong? I said, I don't know, man. I don't know, but I'm not okay. So I knew that it was, at that point, something was really, really wrong with me. And it just got worse from there. It just got worse from there. I mean, I couldn't eat. I was throwing up all the time. But yet, I wanted to be eating all the time. It felt like I was, like, emotionally eating. But I couldn't keep it down. I was sweating. My hair was falling out. I couldn't poop. I couldn't stop pooping, so obviously I'm having stomach issues. It was horrible. It was horrible. I felt I felt terrified in some of the most safest, intimate situations. I could be laying in my bed, safe, next to my husband, watching a TV show that we both enjoyed, and then all of a sudden, I would sit up in a panic, and I couldn't breathe. My lips were tingling, and I just had to try and breathe through this. It was a panic attack. I started having nasty panic attacks, anxiety attacks, out of nowhere. And it wasn't until I started to learn about what was happening to me and why it's happening and how it happens, and starting to kind of understand how post-traumatic stress works in our mind, our brain, in our bodies, I really felt better. I will equate it to when I laid eyes on the 9mm that shot me in the face. It was almost a calm that came about me, because at least I knew what I was being shot with at this point. If that makes any sense.
Yes, yes, I see what you're saying.
Right. Same thing with the PTS. As soon as I started to identify what was happening to me, oh, okay, so I'm not going nuts. I'm not crazy. This is totally normal, because this is how the body stores traumatic stress. It stores it in the cellular core of our brain, in the amygdala. And like anything else, when it swells, it secretes, right? It secretes the hormone that we have in fight or flight. And your body will react accordingly, even if you're just laying safe in your bed next to your spouse or your dog or whoever. So I started to do the work, and it changed my life. I started to do the work more and more when I saw how it was affecting my kids. You know, my daughter developed anxiety. She started having nightmares. My son lost a relationship because he totally disconnected and could not articulate the pain that he was feeling. He was very angry at me that I went back to work. He was very angry at me that I chased these suspects after they'd shot me twice. And in his eyes, you know, they almost murdered you once. Why the heck would you go and chase them? Did you not think of us? Did you not think of, you know, how that was going to affect us? And I didn't.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I didn't at the time. But to explain that to your kids, that I didn't think of you, but not because I don't love you. I thought of you because I didn't think of you because I needed my mind clear to focus, to do everything I needed to do to make it home safe. But you can't expect your children to understand that. You know what I'm saying? Because in their eyes, they don't see Officer Carrizales. In their eyes, they see, this is my mom.
Sure.
And before anything, you should want to come home to us. And so we struggled through a lot together. My husband just was just trying to keep it together. He didn't know what to do for me. If he asked me if I was okay, he asked me about 50 million times a day. So I'm snapping his head off because he's asking me if I'm okay all the time. But then if he stops asking me, I'm like, well, don't you care? You know, like the poor guy couldn't win, you know. And I was... I'm not embarrassed to say, I was getting my butt handed to me in round three. I really, truly was. And then even when I had started to do the work, you know, I was still getting my butt kicked. And then I saw my daughter on the stand in court, Randy, and something she said, it changed everything.
What did she say?
She was testifying, and I was released from the rule at that point, so I could sit in there. And they were asking my daughter, who at the time was, I think, 10 or 11, 11 or so. They were trying to establish maturity level. Do you know the difference between right or wrong? And I'm watching my daughter, who insisted that I allow her to testify. Because she, you know, when she asked me if I was going to let her testify in the first trial, because we've had two of three, I told her, no, absolutely not. I didn't want her in the room with those evil people. But I told her, if you can come up with a good argument and a valid reason why you should be allowed, then bring it to me and we'll discuss it. And so she said to me, I don't need to think about it. So, well, you got to tell me. Go think about it. This is serious. I don't need to think about it. So she says, I want to testify because I want to have my say. I want to let them know that they didn't break me. Not the youngest person in our family. They couldn't break us. And, of course, that was a great argument. I'll let her testify. So she's on the stand testifying. And she gets to the part where the attorney asks about her standing over me and watching me in my sleep. And she started to say that, yes, I used to do that. I used to watch my mom in her sleep because I was always afraid she would die in her sleep and she would not wake up. She had this phobia that her mother was just going to die. So she's explaining this, and at some point while she's explaining this, she gets emotional. And she stops herself and says, excuse me, I'm sorry. She stops and she gets herself together, and then she continues to testify. And that really bothered me. For some reason, that really bothered me. I couldn't understand why my child, who was testifying about something so traumatic that happened to her mother and how it's affected her, felt that she needed to apologize for getting emotional and stop and gather her bearing and then continue and not cry. And that bothered me. So when we got home, I asked her about it. You know, I asked her about it, and she basically looked at me and said, yeah, because I said, why did you cry? Why did you? She says, you know, Mom, I just looked out and I saw the police that were sitting in there, and I knew that they probably had kids, and I didn't want to make them feel guilty for doing something honorable.
Wow.
And I remember, Randy, feeling like somebody punched me in the stomach, because what she just did was regurgitate my words that I had shouted at my husband one day when I thought we were just having a private, heated discussion. I'm so tired of being made to feel guilty for doing something so honorable. Because as parents, you know, in law enforcement, we do that. We do carry a lot of guilt, you know, especially, and this is nothing against the fathers, but the mommies. We really, really feel terrible when we've got to go work a beat and our child's at home sick with a fever.
Yeah.
Because let's just face it, Randy, they don't want their daddies when they're sick. They want their mommies, you know? And I always had a lot of guilt, like many. I've never met an officer alive, a male or female, who didn't feel guilty for missing a birthday or causing the family strife because of what we go through at work. This is why a lot of officers don't share with their spouses. And when she said that, basically she was repeating what she heard me yelling at my husband one day. And it hit me. It hit me all at once. My child is trying to be strong and mask her pain so that I could feel like they were all okay, so that I wouldn't feel guilty to go out and work a beat anymore. And that was unacceptable to me. That was just unacceptable to me, because in my mind, if I had a partner show up on the scene with me who was hurt, I would want them to tell me they were hurt so I could pick up the slack. But yet, I was making my family feel like they could not do that. I was failing them.
I was failing them. You got help. You got help. Tell me how that then took place. That you reached out and were effectively treated for your PTSD.
Yes, I did. I reached out for help. I actually talked to a therapist after my round one for one or two sessions, because after my round one, I wanted to make sure that I got the jump on it before it got the jump on my family. And I saw this woman who works in critical incident stress management. I was bound and determined that I didn't want to go see a shrink because I didn't want to get put on meds. So I found a therapist through critical incident stress management. And her name was Sherry. Her name is Sherry. I went and I saw her. I saw her a couple times. And I'm like, hey, I'm good to go. She's like, yeah, you know, but you should still continue. And I did not. So then I had my round two, and then I found myself in my round three getting pummeled. And I'm going, okay, I need to go and enlist the help of a trainer who is going to give me a different strategy so that I can fight this opponent off of me. And that was Sherry, who sent me to a cut man, which was the psychiatrist, because we went through all of the training, all of the therapy sessions, and the anxiety was just so bad that I needed to be on medicine for a bit for my anxiety.
Right.
So she went ahead and recommended me to a psychiatrist who I like to refer to as the cut man, because I was getting beat up pretty good. And I went, and I let the cut man do his job. And I took the medicine for anxiety for about 8 or 9 months. I did not need it anymore. The more I learned about post-traumatic stress and how it worked, the better I got at dealing with it. And I eventually got better. I got to the point where I could deal with it whenever I felt like I was having a little anxiety running up. I basically could see the writing on the wall. It's just like us as cops. You know, we can look at some situations and know when this is going to go south. And we can look at other situations and say, this is going to be, we can de-escalate this. You know, it just comes with the experience. And I just got a little more experience. I educated myself. I did the work. I did what I was supposed to do. I committed to take the medicine. Throw my pride aside. I took the medicine. I got some sleep. You know,
right.
I needed sleep. I got sleep because that's another way that our body heals and repairs and recharges. And I followed the doctor's orders is what I did. And I found myself getting better and better. I started to share, of course, my story. I find that has helped me grow in leaps and bounds. And I basically embraced my new normal, because a lot of what I hear a lot of officers say when I go out and speak, it's very much the way I felt. I just want to be normal again. I just want to be my old self again. When is this going to stop? When is this going to go away? And it's never really going to go away per se, but if you do the work you will learn about it, you'll learn how to deal with it, and you will get it under control. Just like, you know, maybe allergies. Sometimes allergies put a can of whoop-butt on you, but other times if you already see the right, oh, I can kind of tell my allergies are acting up, then you do what you got to do to take care of it, or you cut out whatever that is causing your allergy to flare up. It's the same thing. I recognize what my triggers are, and I stay free from those. Sometimes I just got to check out and shut all the noise off and allow myself that quiet to reflect, to heal, just to have peace. And once I started to do that and embrace my new normal and really just become more accepting of myself, I made a lot of progress with my kids. My marriage really got a lot better. It was starting to fall apart. I was destroying everybody. And what I like to use as an illustration is, if Randy, you were sitting at home, because you're married, right?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm married. So if I'm sitting at home, and somebody kicks my front door in, right? And they start this home invasion on me and my house where my family is. The first thing I'm going to do, and I know that you would do if you had, I'm sure you have a family, even if you're not married, you have family, right? So you're sitting in your house with your family, these guys kick your door in, and they mean to do harm in your home. Well, you're going to jump up, and you're going to fight with everything that you have. It doesn't matter if you're tired. It doesn't matter if you're hurting. You're going to fight with everything that you have to keep these people, to keep this threat outside of your home, because it's not just me, you know, it's my family, those around us. And nobody that I know alive in law enforcement especially would just lie down and allow someone to kick their door and come take all their stuff, beat and rape your wife or your children. They just wouldn't let that happen. They would have to die fighting, right? But that's what I was doing. I was allowing that to happen. And when I finally saw the pain and the horrible effects it was having on my family, that I finally said, nope, oh, no, 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 and I started fighting. So if you can ever imagine that, you would never let someone kick the door down into your house and wreak havoc on you or do harm on your family, you or your family. That's exactly what standing up, educating yourself, and working on your issues when you have post-traumatic stress, that's exactly what you're doing.
That's a really graphic example. I appreciate that, and we're running out of time. How can people? You do speaking engagements all over the country.
Absolutely, do. I made a vow to share it with everybody.
How can people contact you?
Pretty easy to find. I'm all over social media. If they just type in Officer Anne Marie Carrizales, I'm easy to find. And also, for speaking inquiries, you can route them over to mmcarrizales@gmail.com. Pretty easy. mmcarrizales@gmail.com. If you don't know how to spell it, I'm sure you'll tell them. And, and if you don't know how to spell it, all you got to do is Google, you know, Google Stafford police officer shot in the face, and it's going to be there. I'm not hard to find, and if they want to reach out to me, not even necessarily for the speaking, but just because they need to reach out to somebody, do it. Don't be a wuss. Reach out, ask somebody for help by somebody who knows, who's been there, who's fought those same demons, because I say, you go, I go, you fight, I fight with you.
AnnMCarrizales.com, and I will post that on the America Out Loud website as well. And thank you so much for being a guest on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I really applaud you, not just for your physical courage, but the emotional courage it takes to get through something as traumatic as what you have been through, and to reach out and help others who are serving. Thanks again for being a guest, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Randy. I appreciate you having me. Keep doing what you're doing, brother.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. And I hope that you got a lot out of the interview with Anne Marie Carrizales. Never be afraid to reach out for help. This is your host, Randy Sutton.